Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 10th, 2013. And a tremendous amount of information to give out to you tonight. The main science topic, I will be giving new information that's going to lead to a new announcement. This is, by the way, not dealing with comets or any of the topics that I've really dealt with before. So this is delving into some new ground, let's put it that way, opening up some new information for the public. And so that's tonight's main science topic. I will give a brief Comet Ison update and also talk about the unbelievable amount of misinformation that's being propagated on the internet. It just doesn't end. First of all, a quick solar update. This past week, we had tremendous weather in all around the world. We had the typhoons in Asia. We had the tremendous tornado systems that moved through the United States all the way from Canada down to the southern states. A lot of damage, a lot of damaging storms. And yesterday, we had a tremendous solar encounter, let's put it that way, because we really didn't have, we had local solar conditions, let's put it that way. And so what has been going on is Comet Ison, when it interacted with Mars last week, started a series of conditions on the sun which we have not seen previously. But those solar flares came out past Earth, and then Earth began interacting with the solar flares. Now, oddly enough, a couple of weeks ago, a listener had written in and asked the question, how do we interact with solar flares, and how long does this last? And so we got a good taste of that. I gave a lecture on that on my show a couple of weeks ago, and here we are, actually experiencing exactly what I was talking about. So very interesting. So okay, the first to start out with, let me give this Comet Ison update just to get this out of the way. And I don't want to dwell and spend a lot of time on Comet Ison, but it is one of the more important scientific issues going on today. But part of this, mainly what I do, is dispel misinformation. First of all, Comet Ison does not have seven planets around it. It's a little comet. It always was a little comet, and I started announcing long ago. I said, what's NASA talking about? This comet is a minor comet. But there are some interesting issues with Comet Ison. So no, it does not have seven planets around it, and there's a YouTube video floating around that appears to be my voice. We've determined that it's a canned voice that's trying to copy and cut and paste from some shows that I did around the year of maybe 2002, but some very old shows, and craftily cut and pasted to make it sound like I'm talking about Comet Ison having seven planets. Well, it simply is not the case. Comet Ison has some very interesting properties, but no, it is not Nibiru. Another misinformation story that's floating around the internet using my name and work. And this is a big smear campaign. It's you have to understand, when you deal with misinformation, they want to control both sides of the story. So they're creating stories using information cut and pasted for me or whatever. And it's simply not me talking. If you want to know what I say, don't go to blogs. I've told people, don't post my name on blogs. I don't like blogs. They're a bunch of goofy mumbo-jumbo, and with all kinds of people with all kinds of strange beliefs and mixing it together that the, you know, if you want to know what I'm saying, you got to come to this webpage. If you want to, you have to listen to this show, read my webpage, and listen to the radio shows where I am a guest and recent, but don't go to YouTube. YouTube is a garbage pit for misinformation. So, first of all, no, Comet Ison does not have seven planets. Total misinformation created by the disinformation crew to try and slam me. No, it is not Nibiru. There are no direct collisions with Earth with dust clouds from Comet Ison. That's actually a story that NASA made up, that somehow there's impending, all kinds of minor planets or asteroids near Earth that were recently discovered. They're all going to crash into Earth. Total misinformation. Then the idea that I have proposed, and it is true, is that comets can affect the sun. That is very true. And we'll see that this week, Comet Ison, after its interaction with Mars, gave the sun a little jolt. And that is what created the severe weather that we saw this past week. But as far as comets hitting the sun, NASA and its minion little outreach mouthpieces out there can't get this straight, and so they keep saying, well, comets can't affect the sun because they're little and they would melt when they get to the sun. Well, no, comets are not little snowballs. They're electrical discharges of the solar capacitor. The electrical size of comets is much larger than their physical size. So you can't just talk about the comet nucleus. And by the way, they're not dirty snowballs. And Comet Ison has proven that emphatically. I'll be talking about that in just a second. But anyway, the point is, I'll mention this too. There's a bunch of clowns running around, jumping up and down, trying to use my name and saying, Jim McCanny says this, Jim McCanny says that. And then they mix it with all kinds of other garbage. They're not doing anybody any favors. So the sky is falling, people, everything is Planet X. And by the way, as far as I know, there is no Planet X object in the solar system at this time. I'm not aware of any. And so I'll just tell you that right now. And if I am, I will tell you. Boy, the misinformation out there is just thick, and it's rather comical in light of the fact that NASA is down. They have created a web page specifically to slam me with authorless articles. People, there's no authors put on these articles, but they're misquoting me. They misquote and then they slam it using their fairy tale science. Anyway, the amount of baloney out there being thrown at the public regarding the real topics of Planet X. What's the real topic of Planet X? There are many, many, many Planet X type of objects that have been discovered. No, they're not all on collision courses with Earth. The story about a 3,600-year orbit has been way overplayed. We have history going back 3,600 years. And the only effect that we've had from external out of solar system bodies was the Venus event. Venus came through the solar system, affected Mars, removed its atmosphere, and had two encounters with Earth before it nestled into its current orbit. And yes, comets can be big, they can become planets, but it is very, very rare. And even if something comes into the solar system, something big, it will appear as a comet, not a big orange ball. And the chances of it coming near Earth are actually pretty small. So, the amount of misinformation floating around is just unbelievable. Okay, so at any rate, the information that is, let me give you the information that is correct about Comet Ison is just a quick review. On September 24th, it turned green, which is a fluorescence. That's the electrical current passing through the comet. And these are all effects. These are very subtle effects. On September 29th, and by the way, I'm sorry, last week I called it October 4th. It was October 3rd when I announced my show. I said it was October 4th. It was October 3rd, so I apologize for that. But anyway, on September 29th, Comet Ison developed a sunward spike as it interacted with Mars, clearly interacting with Mars on October 2nd. This is one day after the close approach of Mars by Comet Ison. Mars went comet, and I observed that myself, and I have gotten many, many, many confirmation reports from listeners who also saw Mars go comet. So this is very, very exciting because you're learning science. And isn't it odd that we have a space agency now shut down where you should be getting this information and learning about science, but all they keep doing is pumping out this fairy tale science, publishing photos by amateurs, fuzzy out of focus photos. And let me make a comment on that, because a place like spaceweather.com is posting amateur photos. Why aren't they posting the real photos that are still being taken by NASA publishing amateur photos? When you take a picture of a comet, even as an amateur, you have to follow the comet. So when you see a picture of a comet, a time-lapse photography image of a comet through an amateur telescope, and you see the star fields nicely in focus, all the stars, pinpoint dots, and the comet, that is a picture that's out of focus because the comet is moving with respect to the stars. And so spaceweather.com is publishing these out-of-focus pictures. They look in focus to a non-qualified observer because the star fields are in focus. Well, you're not taking a picture of the star fields, amateurs out there. Get it right. You have to follow the comet. It's much more complicated than tracking a comet with the amateur. And so what we're getting are a bunch of out-of-focus pictures, which don't show the sunward spike. If these were in focus, they would clearly show the sunward spike that persists with Comet Ison. And the sunward spike is continuing to persist with Comet Ison. And I suspect we're going to see this Comet Ison continue to be green. It's still green. It's still very much an excited comet. And we have to wait now until early November when it starts to interact with the planet Mercury. And there, by the way, I am not saying definitely that Mercury will go comet, as some idiots out there are trying to paraphrase what I say. So I did not say absolutely, but I just said we have a high probability of the planet Mercury going comet. In other words, turning into a comet. And what I'd love to see is for Mercury to develop into a comet and have a visible comet tail in the morning sky, something that you could actually see with the naked eye. But just put that on your calendar, a beautiful moonless, no moon involved morning sky starting around November 10th, 11th, 12th, the 13th, and the 14th is when the actual best linear solar wind, and you have to qualify this because the solar wind is not in a straight line. So there are many factors here. But around the 13th and 14th of November, we could see Comet Ison exciting, becoming maybe even a blue comet, and developing a good sunward spike, connecting possibly to the planet Mercury up in the early morning sky. And maybe you should get up in starting November 10th and identify the planet Mercury. That's a little bit difficult for the average person, but it is a naked eye visible object up there. And so that would be a good exercise. And then when Comet Ison moves in behind it, Comet Ison may not be naked eye visible at that point, but it might be. We don't know at this point. Right now, currently, Comet Ison is not naked eye visible. You still need a little bit of optical equipment to see it. But at any rate, that's the story with Comet Ison. I'm not going to dwell on this, but I have to give you an update. And just beware of the massive amount of misinformation out there. And let me repeat, Comet Ison does not have seven planets orbiting around it. Comet Ison is a small comet. It's a very intense comet. It is not Nibiru. I never said that, never would say that in a million years. So you can see the extent that these groups are going to try and smear my name and my work. By the way, this NASA webpage that they just threw up yesterday, the authors, there are no author names associated with these, and there's no blog. Isn't that interesting? There's no place to put a listener comment. As my fans would be all over this, telling them that that's not what I'm saying and redirecting them to my webpage. But ultimately, people end up on my webpage, realize the extent that NASA is going to. But by the way, the other interesting part here is NASA is shut down. So who is creating this webpage? This is NASA employees are not allowed to do anything, because I know a lot of these people. They can't go in the door. They can't see data. They can't turn on a computer. So who is posting this web page in the name of NASA? You know, it just doesn't get any deeper out there. That's why they call them PhDs, piled higher and deeper. You know, and that's really the case. By the way, all of those scientists that work for NASA and the government are all out of their jobs. You know, they're all gone. Many of them probably will never come back, so that's what they get for selling their lives to the government. That's the thanks they get. They just get thrown out one day with nothing, no pay, no excuses, bye, gone. So, way to be, scientists. 99.99% of all scientists and engineers somehow work for the government. In that 0.00001% is where I am. I don't work for the government, never have worked for the government. By the way, some people have accused me of being somehow a government, controlled by the government or something. No, I am totally independent. Your purchases on this, my webpage, are what drives this show and the other expenses associated with it. I don't take a profit from this. I do this because I'm putting out my information, which you can see right now, Comet Ison turning green, interacting with Mars. By the way, the standard science story coming out of Standard Science for why Comet Ison is green is they say, oh, that's ultraviolet light of the sun. Well, ultraviolet light from the sun is all over the place. What's so special about the ultraviolet light near the planet Mars? Is there some special planet Mars ultraviolet light? No, the reality is when ultraviolet light leaves the sun, it spreads out in all directions, like a light bulb. So the source of light, in this case ultraviolet light, which they're claiming causes the comet to go green, that light is every place. So when Comet Ison approaches Mars and turns green, it's because it's near Mars. It's interacting electrically with Mars. So you can see the fairy tale tier 2 science that's being thrown at you to try and explain away the reality. Comets are not dirty snowballs. They never were, never could be. I knew that back in the 1970s when I was at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. I was studying and I had access to NASA data. I knew at that point that comets could not possibly in a million years be dirty snowballs. No way in Hades. But this fairy tale science continues today. But remember, part of the problem is that there's a complicity, and I explain this in my book, The Diamond Principle. There's a complicity between astronomy and the energy industry. Because if people woke up en masse and understood that comets are electrical, and that outer space is electrical, and that around the turn of the 1900s, a guy named Tesla had learned how to tap into that, getting the collecting the energy down here at the Earth using his Tesla towers, then we could run our societies, our entire energy needs, from the vast, unlimited amount of electrical energy passing by Earth every day in outer space. Do you see the problem here? So they can't let the astronomers out of their little boxes to talk about anything except little dirty snowballs that can't affect the sun, that don't do anything, and maybe one day they might crash into Earth, but we sure don't want to talk about that either, because you might not go out and pay your mortgage or your insurance bill or honor the funny money that they're passing around the world today. So at any rate, you know, there's a lot of political correctness that has to be maintained. Well, all of those little politically correct tier 2 scientists are out on their ear right now, and I bet you there's a lot of them listening to this show right now, wondering what they're going to do, how they're going to make their next house payment, how the kids are going to stay in college, because they gave their life, they prostituted their careers to a government that doesn't give any more of a rat's behind about them than the man in the moon. So anyway, sure is funny. That's all I can say. It's funny, but it's not. And that's a very sad statement for the state of science today in the world. Okay, quick solar update. The sun this past week, let me start with yesterday, we had a very strange solar-wind interaction. That's all I can tell you, because we did not really take a solar flare. We took kind of a mini solar flare, but the reaction that Earth had was much greater than simply the solar flare that reached Earth from a bit of a pop that occurred on the sun a number of days ago. We are reacting locally to these solar flares, and that is causing the energy equation, you might call it, the energy distribution that caused our severe weather. This severe weather came out of nowhere. It was not predicted. I watched the weather reports because I had reason to be concerned about what the weather was going to be like, partially because I was observing Comet Ison, and I wanted to be in nice, clear conditions. So the weather that occurred was not predicted. Let me make that clear. All of that severe weather this past week. But we had, prior to that, we had the typhoons in Asia. We had the massive tornado systems that moved across the United States. Amazing amount of storm activity. And what I discovered and published in my weather book, it's probably close to a decade ago, is that it is the rapid change of solar conditions that causes severe weather. It's not simply that we are passing in a tremendous amount of energy field, you might call it, because the electrical energy is passing by us all the time in outer space. When the solar wind or the magnetic conditions in the solar wind or the electrical currents that are contained in the solar wind change rapidly, that is when we have severe weather. The severe weather is... basically, here's what happens. We just went through a new moon passing phase, which is another tremendous contributing factor. Here's what happens. The new moon is between us and the sun. That's why it's called a new moon. The sunlight side of the moon is on the far side, on the sunward side. And so we just get a little glimpse of the crescent. Okay, it is also blocking the solar wind. The comet, the moon is out there acting as a comet, buffering the solar wind in out way beyond our magnetic field, our plasma magnetic field, which only extends about 30,000 miles out to the sunward side, and that varies with time, but about that. Let's say, for example, the moon is out a quarter of a million miles, so it's way out there by itself. It's acting as a comet and buffering the solar wind. When it moves out of the way, the connection to the solar wind that it had gets released, and the solar wind comes pounding in, it compresses Earth's plasma magnetic field, and that in turn causes basically like an EMP. That's a popular term that I could use because people are starting to understand that. But a mild EMP, it compresses our magnetic field, and that compresses the ionosphere, which triggers, it helps, it's one of the factors that triggers the flow of electrical energy down to the surface of the Earth, which drives our storm systems. And so, at any rate, at that point, a lot of water also can influx into the atmosphere, into these storm systems. So, at any rate, that's what happened. Right now, by the way, I've been watching a comet come into the sun, and I have not been able to download the information from the various satellites that are observing the sun, and so I don't know what happened yet. This morning, the feeds to those started to become blocked, at least where I am. And if anybody has that information, please send it along. Some of the NASA websites stopped posting around October 6th, and so there was no record of this comet. NASA incorrectly calls them Crookes comets. They said that these have been coming in since around the 1850s. There was a German astronomer who studied comets and noticed that many of these comets came in very quickly from the south. So he hypothesized, or somebody hypothesized in modern fairy tale science, that these were part of a comet that broke up, and so they're still streaming into the sun. Well, what a ridiculous idea. If something big broke up out there in the outer solar system, it would all come raining in within a couple days, not over a 150-year span. So clearly, there's something that is causing comets to come in from the south. But at any rate, the current situation is this comet this morning came in and obviously by now would have hit the sun, but I don't have any access to data to tell you what happened. And when this, typically what happens is before the comet gets to the sun, it interacts electrically with the sun and causes solar flaring. So that's what I'm expecting to happen here. But like I say, the feeds have been down, and there's no information available to tell what actually happened to that comet. So that hopefully I'll have better information and be posting that on my webpage. By the way, the webpage is jmccsci.com. And another point I want to make here is, especially for new listeners, you have to get my books and DVDs and read them, extensive amount of information explaining the plasma discharge comet model that I'm talking about here. It's totally different concept than anything you've ever heard before. The fairy tale science about dirty snowballs, totally incorrect, totally 100% incorrect, and that's what's being fed to you by standard science. So this has so many effects on your life, your daily lives, not only in terms of science, but in terms of political, what's going on in the political world. So I'm not going to go into that right now. But at any rate, the term I developed, action at a distance, that means that comets can affect the sun at a distance. And so let me make this very clear, because all of the little NASA websites, the outreach sites, try and say, well, the comet didn't hit the sun yet, and that's when the solar flare came out, so it couldn't have been the comet. Well, no. You got the head in the sand effect. They don't want to admit that I'm correct, that comets can affect the sun at a distance. And why is that? That is because the comet is discharging the solar capacitor. It is interacting with the sun at a distance, just like comets can interact with the sun with the Earth at a distance. Okay, I'm just going to, there are so many new people here. My old listeners, please bear with me while I just quickly review the books and information that's available on my webpage, because this is very, very important. you have to spend some serious amount of time here on this information. If you want a 15-second sound bite and you think you're going to walk away with all the information and mix it with something you already know, then please go away from this website because it's in my radio show because it's not for you. This is only for people who want to spend a serious amount of time learning. Because just about everything you have been taught about the solar system, about comets, about outer space, about weather, something that affects us every day, everything you have been taught, everything you hear on the Weather Channel, everything you see on spaceweather.com is all fairy tale garbage. It has nothing to do with reality. And you might say, well, how could all these scientists be misguided? Well, that's exactly what has happened. You have a lot of misguided science and a lot of people who don't know how to ask questions. Here's what has happened, just in a nutshell. Most astronomers, space scientists, geologists, meteorologists, etc., took some science, some hardcore science, maybe early in college. They may have passed a physics course with a lot of luck, but that's where it ended. And so they don't have any background with which to question. Then they moved into their specialty field, learned a lot of mumbo-jumbo, and they've been repeating it ever since. Astronomy is the science of studying the stars and the planets and their positions, etc. Space science, you would think these people have good physics backgrounds, but they don't. When they got done with whatever level they stopped taking physics, they started learning theoretical concepts regarding how outer space works, and that's where the problem is. The vast majority of that is simply incorrect. You have to read my books. I'm not going to go into waste this radio show. You have to read my books. Just quickly, there are now eight books, available, all of them available in e-format, electronic books, except for the book Calculate Primes, which is a solution to a 2,500-year-old mathematical problem that I produced, resolving the direct calculation of prime numbers. So the other books entitled Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, Surviving Planet X Passage. The third book is Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. The fourth book is called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, which is a Latin title, but we jestfully call it the Weather Book. Then there's the Calculate Primes book, which comes with a three-hour lecture DVD showing how to directly calculate the prime numbers. Then the Diamond Principle, which is a very important book. It analyzes modern society and talks about science and the reasons why bad astronomy and physics and other concepts are pawned off on the public. Then the last two books, the first one of the most recent books coming out is simply called Comets. And that's a book you have to read given the current conditions, the situation with Comet Ison. You have to read that book. The last book is called Water. It talks about the political control of water in the world. Then there's the 2-CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, 18 hours of lecture on that topic. There's the 2-DVD set. You can see me as a young person talking about my science. There are 8 historically important videos of lectures that I gave remastered on DVDs. That's the DVD set number 1 and 2. There's a third DVD, which is the first of a series of lectures. Then there's the calendar, the emergency survival recalendar sun star clock. Go to the webpage, all this is there, and then the entire line of emergency and daily use water filter products, things that you need in an emergency. The main thing you are going to need is water. So enough of that, just giving you a brief idea of what is on the sales page on subpage of my webpage, the webpage JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. That's seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. Okay, on to the main science topic. Okay, this is kind of the fun part of what I do. Fun for me, and hopefully fun for you, is prepping people for a new discovery release. Now, as everything is going on out in the public eye, I am working in the background. And every now and then, I am able to produce information of what I do personally, my personal research, that I can release to the public in a form that you're going to understand. And so the next topic coming up is very interesting. And there's always two rules that I use when releasing new information. It builds on all the information that I have out there already. And that is why, especially if you're new to this, you have to get my books and information to learn what's going on in the world of science and around you. And then you can build on that to understand the next concept coming out, which is going to release here soon. So the other thing is that every new release takes a 90-degree turn. It's orthogonal, if you will, to all the past work that I've done. So it takes on a new direction. So it's based on past work, takes on a completely new direction. So this is rather exciting. So what I do is kind of take your mind for the couple weeks before, and I condition it so that you understand, you're will be mentally prepared when the new topic comes out. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is rather interesting. What do these things have in common? Symmetry, church design, modern art, and man's praise to a divine entity. Okay, that's four different topics. What do they have in common? And what they have in common, I'll be talking about, but that leads into the next topic. And it's a rather esoteric topic. And so anyway, well, let me start out with symmetry. Let's look at symmetry around us. Let's look at galaxies. If you go to internet sites, or if you go to these big, beautiful astronomy books, I don't know how many are still available out there, but they're pictures of galaxies. And, you know, these big coffee table books on astronomy, pictures, etc. Many of them have pictures of galaxies, but the galaxies are symmetrical. In a sense, they're asymmetrical, but here's what you would do. Open up a book or pull up your computer, galaxies, pictures of a galaxy. And typically what you'll see is a big spiral, okay? A spiral, and then you can definitely see where the nucleus is. It's towards the center. It's the brightest spot in the picture. And that's where the galactic nucleus lies. Okay, so now take your ruler and measure out in one direction. Put the number 6 on your ruler. If you have a foot ruler or a yard ruler, take the center point of that ruler. If you have a yardstick, then take the 18-inch point. If you have a foot ruler, take the 6-inch center point and put that on the galactic nucleus, okay? And now look out at various parts of the spiral arms and measure out, and what you're going to find is what we call star density. Star density is the number of stars in clusters in a certain point in the galactic arms. And you're going to see that on the right side and on the left side of the picture, out exactly the same distance from the center of the galaxy, from the galactic nucleus, the same distance out into the arms, you're going to find a cluster here and then a cluster over there. Or you might find a place where there aren't any stars at all. Okay? And so, but they're symmetrical. If it's on one side of the nucleus, exactly on the other side of the nucleus, there's either a bunch of stars or a lack of stars or some kind of strange configuration. The disk may warp. This is another property of galaxies, is that they warp. They're like a record disk, so to speak, but at a certain point they twist. And from that point, the arms, they actually warp out. And so it's a very interesting property of galactic arm structure. But they're symmetrical. The question is, how did the arm over here, which is, say, 100,000 light years away from the arm over there, how did they know to develop stars or not develop stars exactly symmetrical with the other side? Well, the standard theory for galaxy development that comes out of fairy tale science is that there was some kind of impulse that got the density wave, a wave like water wave, rolling around in the dust matter in the galaxy, and that somehow compressed the matter, causing stars to form. Well, that sure sounds slick, but it doesn't explain the symmetry. How did this density wave that magically came from supposedly another passing galaxy, and then, by the way, how did that galaxy form in the first place? If you need a density wave, how did the first galaxy form? Well, it couldn't have, because there were no galaxies to help it form. So, you know, the fairy tale science has all kinds of first and second level flaws that nobody talks about. But at any rate, the symmetry of galaxies is primary. It's fundamental to understanding how galaxies form. And so when I was publishing my original papers, actually the first peer-reviewed paper that I had published when I was at Cornell University, I was in the mathematics department, was on the formation of galaxies to explain the symmetry property in galaxies. And that paper, by the way, is in the appendix of my Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes books. It's one of the appendices in that book. And so the point is, or is it in the Atlantis to Tesla book? But anyway, you have to read all of my books, so it is in the appendices in those books. It might be in the Atlantis to Tesla book. But at any rate, the point is that symmetry is extremely important in nature. Take a look in a mirror. Look at yourself. We are symmetrical people, beings. You have a division that comes down the front. You have the arms symmetrical. You have your nostrils, your teeth, your eyes. Everything is symmetrical. So we are symmetrical people. there's the artwork of, say, Picasso. Modern art, a lot of it is based on distortion of reality, because we expect two eyes to be aside each other. One of the famous Picasso paintings is eyes are one above the other, a very distorted picture of, I believe it's a soldier. But at any rate, the point is that asymmetry is, we see as unnatural, and that's what gives Picasso kind of his air of uniqueness, is because he distorts. He takes the symmetrical world and distorts it in his paintings. And that's kind of a interesting effect. But the reason we identify with Picasso is because he distorts our perception that we always expect to see symmetry in nature. So let me talk about some other naturally occurring symmetries. Let's talk about snowflakes. Snowflakes are always six-sided. What an interesting concept, but it's a property of the water molecule that's built up, and I talk about this in my Calculate Primes book, the symmetry, the six-sided symmetry in snowflakes. Well, six is a very important number in the prime number system. You have to read my prime number book to understand why. It's a complex topic. But the number 7, which is one of the prime numbers, is a central point with a 6 evenly distributed points around it. For example, you could take nickels. Take 7 nickels or pennies or quarters, 7 of the same coins, and make a pattern. And what you're going to find is 7 of them make an interesting pattern. You put 1 in the center and 6 around them. And that is the basis for snowflake symmetry. It's a prime number. 7 is a prime number, and it's the basis for snowflake symmetry, which is a very interesting concept. But you have beautiful, beautiful symmetry in a snowflake, some of them growing to very large sizes. But if you want, also look up on the internet or get books. There are books of snowflake pictures. Look at the pictures, and there's a 6-sided symmetry in all of these. And so you have to ask, well, how did this side over here know to create the snowflake, which is unique? Every snowflake is unique. Every pattern of snowflakes is unique. How did the side over here know to make its crystalline pattern of water molecules the same as the side over there? Well, there's an answer to that, and it's very similar to the understanding how galaxies work. That information came out electrically from the center of the snowflake. Snowflakes, and interestingly enough, there were some people working in laboratories trying to duplicate snowflakes. And so what they would take, they knew it started with a dust grain, some kind of piece of dirt or something, microscopic. And around that, the crystal would grow. But they really didn't know how these would grow, so they tried to create the conditions in clouds in a laboratory, in a vacuum chamber. And they had water molecules vaporized and all the correct atmospheric conditions, but they couldn't create a snowflake. Until one of them got the idea one day, I believe it was based on my work, that there are electrical conditions in the clouds. So they put an electric field at the end of the dust. They had a pinpoint that went out, and that was where the dust particle was held. So they put an electric field on the pin, and voila, snowflakes began to form. Prior to that, they had just very distorted, kind of ugly, linear crystal formations. But after they put an electric field, a slight electric field, on the pin that was holding the dust particle, beautiful snowflakes immediately emerged. So it was due to the electrical conditions in the cloud that were fundamental for creating the shape and symmetry in a snowflake. Very important. And of course, my work shows how the electric fields in clouds are a fundamental response to the solar conditions in the passing by every day. And these are translated into the cloud systems. That's where lightning comes from. I gave a lecture a number of weeks ago on the source of lightning and the fact that modern science has finally admitted they don't know what causes lightning. Well, I have answered that question. I had it answered decades ago in my work, showing that the electrical fields in clouds and lightning are part of a much larger electrical circuit in the solar system. But anyway, galaxies and snowflakes are two very interesting examples of symmetry. We have shells, like seashells, that are asymmetrical. They form in the shape of a spiral. And if you take a crosscut, like a nautilus, for example, or a conch shell or other types of shells, if you cut through the shell laterally, you find an asymmetrical spiral. In other words, it continues to grow out as the animal continues to live in this, and the animal grows that lives in the conch. The shell itself develops and grows. It's constantly growing into a spiral shape. That type of shape, you would say, is an asymmetrical shape in nature. The prime numbers Now, for this, you have to read my book, Calculate Primes. But the prime numbers themselves are symmetrical. It's a property that no one in the mathematics world would have ever imagined, that the prime numbers would have symmetry. It's a property that I showed in my Calculate Primes work, and it's fundamental to understanding arithmetic. And by the way, just as an aside note, the acceptance of my prime number work is it's worldwide. The people that are in this field very much know about it, but once again, they've been basically muffled, because if, for example, you took my prime number work solely by itself, it resolves the oldest mathematical problem in history, going back to the Greeks over 2,500 years ago, to resolve the direct calculation and understanding the patterns of the prime numbers. It's a huge, historically huge discovery. Yet it's being muffled because if just on its own, if you just took that out of my work and only looked at that alone, it would be enough to put my name on the top of the list of mathematicians and physicists throughout history, up amongst the very top names. But if you did that, then that would illuminate all of the work I've done on comets, on the electrical conditions in the universe, the formation of galaxies, the fact that the Big Bang is a ridiculous idea, and there is another source of redshift, which I discovered, called the induced electric dipole redshift. All of these concepts would be pushed into the forefront because of nothing more than the fame of the solution of the prime number problem. But in that solution, one of the end results is the symmetry of prime numbers. Okay, so let's look at another aspect. I talked about church designs. What do church designs have to do with the new topic that I'm going to be releasing soon? If you go into any cathedral or church or chapel, go to the middle aisle and look up from the back of the church or chapel, whatever. What you're going to see is tremendous symmetry. This is man's praise to his divine creator, or the person that they look up to in the universe. Understand that this is man's reflection of perfection. This is their statement to their divine creator, telling him that, look, we're making our best design here to worship you. In our own human frail way, we're trying to include all of the properties of divine greatness to show you our adoration. That's basically what a church or a mosque or any type of religious building is trying to illuminate. And so you look at the symmetry, so that has to be ingrained in man's, basically as in man's psyche, that symmetry is a very important property of nature, and therefore of God and of everything we look to when we want to go beyond our frail human earthly existence and praise the divine creator. And if you look at symmetry, let's go to mathematics. Mathematics is one of the purer forms of science. In mathematics, mathematicians love symmetry. There are symmetries and asymmetries. For example, a simple trigonometric function of the sine function is asymmetrical. If you go out from the zero point on the number line, if you go to the right and the left, the values on the right are the opposite of the values on the left. But if you look at the cosine function in mathematics, it's symmetrical. The value of the function on the right side of the number line is equal to the number on the left side, therefore is symmetrical. So you have symmetries and asymmetries, and when you combine these, you get some strange effects. You get other functions which have symmetries and asymmetries, etc. So this is a whole concept in mathematics. So mathematicians love symmetry. They love to see things that are symmetrical, and it gives you kind of a balance. It kind of gives you a feeling. If you know one side of the equation, then you know the other side and all of its properties. So to see symmetry in nature, in galaxies, in snowflakes, in mathematical functions, is something that's very important. You can prove or disprove things by symmetry. So this segment, I want to show you why the Dirty Snowball Comet model, due to symmetry, could not possibly be correct. In outer space, you're dealing with many different kinds of effects, but let's try and look at the concept of a dirty snowball. And if you see the NASA artist conceptions, which don't pan out in reality, because when you get up to a nucleus of a comet, there's no ice or snow or water on the nucleus, and there's nothing coming off the nucleus. So where does the tail material come from? Well, the answer is that the tail material is coming in towards the nucleus, and when it gets there, it's either burnt onto the nucleus with powerful electrical currents, or it is being whisked off as neutrals. But the point is that the jets, the so-called jets that are coming out of so-called crevices from a comet nucleus, come out asymmetrical. And if that were the case, and they were huffing and puffing and blowing this way, then that way, and the nucleus was rotating, you would not see the beautiful symmetrical comet coma that surrounds a comet. You would see streamers over here, then streamers over there, then they would be turning around and spewing out the side over here, and you would see the spewing streamers in the various directions, and they would not produce the beautiful symmetric comas that we see in comets. So at any rate, this is the first series of a series of lectures preparing you for the upcoming release that I will be giving out in a number of weeks. So at any rate, make sure you tune in next week for lesson number 2 of this new release. And remember to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Your purchases support this show and the ongoing battle against bad science that's coming out of NASA, the tremendous amount of misinformation that's going on out there. It's just raging. I have never seen anything like this before. So you got to be educated. You got to know why this is happening. But stay tuned. And if you want to know what I say, go to my webpage. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.